L.A. Lloyd here, and we're happy to welcome back my good friend Scott Stevens, who, never sits idle. He's always doing something, and this time we're going to be talking a little bit about his music and also some other artists he's worked with. So we got a lot to cover today, man. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Lloyd, man. It's so good to reconnect the way we have over the last year, and you've been such a huge supporter of the music. One of the biggest supporters, if not the biggest, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that so much.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I had you on the show last October, and that was the same weekend that Spirits High hit number one. Obviously, it had been going up the chart for weeks and weeks and weeks and finally hit the top. So I see you wearing your management in the Gooch shirt today. So just kind of curious what the reaction was, you know, once it finally happened with them, and also just the overwhelming response you got from the fans.
When it hit number one, everybody was, they were pleased. I mean, I think they saw it climbing, and we started to have conversations about what does this mean now and how do we take this to the next level. Everybody was pleased. And yeah, I'm always getting Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, messages from people saying how much this song helps them in a time of trouble, to try to keep some optimism going. And I always say that that's what it did for me. And if that's the connection that we have from it, so be it. And what a great gift to be a part of, you know?
Yeah. And talking about people that you've just been involved with who've hit the milestone of number one on the Rock 30, the other is Chris Daughtry, who, his song Artificial hit number one February 24th on the Rock 30. And he was just ecstatic, just like you were. I mean, he's like, man, I've been doing this for so long, and to finally hit that. There's something about that number one spot. You know, you can be on the charts and you can have success, but at the end of the day, the chart thing has been around almost as long as rock and roll has, man. And to hit that number one spot, I got to think that you and him probably had some high fives and some great conversations about his success.
We did. We weren't together, but we talked a few different times during the day. And, you know, that song was one of those that kind of came out of nowhere. And once it started to show itself to us, all the other songs that we were working on were shelved. And we just focused on that song and just kept on going at it and going at the lyric. And, you know, I think it took us a while to figure out how to get to the tag and how that would, you know, sew that artificial line up. But once we cracked that code, it felt so good. And, you know, when you labor over something like we did on that, and then you see the reaction after it gets out to the world and it's not your song anymore, that's the greatest gift, you know, to watch that thing go. And we, at one time, talking to him and going, dude, it was a great ride. I mean, it's like number five or something. And look, I mean, it's been on the charts for like 30 weeks. I go, that's a hit, if you ask me. Doesn't necessarily number one doesn't always mean that.
Right. There's so many producers that, well, I don't say a lot, but there's some producers in very high demand, and you probably know kind of where I'm going with this, but with their success, they have the one-size-fits-all approach to their producing. And, you know, in my opinion, that's kind of hurt some bands because it started getting to the place where everyone wanted to work with a certain producer, but they all started kind of sounding very similar. Now, how do you as a producer, you know, you work with so much diverse talent, how do you not, you know, still put your stamp on it, but, you know, where it's not the one-size-fits-all because it's a one-by-one case scenario, I guess?
The one thing that I think about when I work with either like Daughtry or Shinedown or Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm or Scott Stapp or whatever, you know, I study it for a little while and I just try to see, you know, what hits me, what I feel is working for others. And I just digest that for a little while. And I never have a template when I start. I don't have, you know, my certain EQs for guitars or my certain things selected for drums. I always kind of go from scratch. And that's why the beginning of the record, which creating the sauce, as I call it, or the soup, is the toughest part. Because once you get that main ingredient and go, okay, these are kind of the drum sounds, this is what it is, then you're off to the races. But it's building and finding those ingredients that fit too. A lot of, I'm always listening to the voice. The voice of the artist is telling me how heavy the guitars have to be, or how heavy the drums, or how light, or if it needs to be more soulful, or whatever it is. So I'm always just listening.
Yeah.
And I think that that might be something that I've kind of developed over the years, is be a good listener.
Well, one thing that I enjoyed viewing on social media is the time that you worked with Dorothy on her upcoming album. And, you know, I could just tell there was something really magical just from the expression on your face or what was being written, you know, when you would complete a song. I know you can't give away everything, but what can fans expect from this one, man? Because it just looked like it was just a really unique experience. And I know how spiritual that Dorothy is, and it must have been, you know, pretty emotional sometimes when you would go back and listen to that final track.
Yes. She runs the gamut of emotions. There's been laughs, tears, anger, happiness, whatever it is. But we broke some new ground on this album. We're basically finished. We're going to be entering the mix stage here pretty soon. And I'm not sure when the first single will drop, but, you know, we carved it up pretty nice. I mean, there is the things that she's been known for, soulful rock. There's things that are a little bit more aggressive. She actually has some screams on this record that are cool, and they don't sound forced, and she kind of just did them. And I happened to be recording, and I caught them. And so, you know, we delved a little bit into what's happening with the Nashville sound and how does that infiltrate. And I think we've successfully, you know, done something unique for her, definitely carving her own path a little bit more too. So it's been a very cathartic, unbelievable experience for the both of us. And, you know, we're not at the finish line yet, but we're getting there.
You know, there's so much that have been added to the story of Spirit's High since you and I first talked about it well over a year ago, and we'll get into that here in just a bit. But when you first wrote that song and got it out and you started sending it out to a few friends in the industry and radio folks like that, was this kind of in your head at that point kind of one and done? And or just did you say, you know, maybe if something does happen with this, I can do on and on and on and on?
Yeah, at the time that I created that song, and I think we talked about this before, it was during COVID, and there was a batch of songs that were all kind of, they kind of were similar in theme, and they were really similar in theme, and they were, you know, kind of all developing at different paces. And that one kind of was the one that I felt like I needed to finish first. And once that was done and I sent it to you, I think I sent it really only to like four people.
Wow.
And you were one of them. And, you know, I your response gave me a lot of confidence to look at it. And I think, you know, Randy Smith, whose name was Boner, he was another one who passed away, you know, or last year.
That's right.
He was a good friend. And, you know, Terry Carr was another, Nelly Wood. And these were people that I'd known for a long time. And I think that the response from all of you helped me to see that maybe it's, you know, oh yeah, should I finish a few more of these songs? And then of course, when I sent it to my drummer, Dennis Wolf from the XEs, he was all about it. And, you know, he was the one that said, what are you going to do with this? We got to do something. You got to do something with this, you know? And so one thing leads to another, and, you know, you add it to the Rock 30, you play it, and somebody else plays it a little bit. And so it's helped to push me to, you know, to want to do more music.
Yeah. And you did. And that's what we're going to go into now, is For What It's Worth. When did you begin writing this? Or was this something that was in that batch you were talking about that you revisited? Or let's kind of go to the beginning of this song, you know, until getting it out, you know, just recently, a few days ago.
Yeah, it was, I think it's 3 years now.
Wow.
so they're all just kind of percolating and sitting. And, you know, I don't think I finished it until the summer of last year.
Okay.
And, you know, but the start of the song, the inception of it, started 3 years ago. I don't know. I wasn't feeling melancholy, but maybe I just had a longing type of feeling, of just like, what have I created, you know, with my life and, you know, the things I've done. And I just kind of wondered, like, you know, did I do enough for myself? Was I enough for my loved ones? Was I enough for friends? Did I give enough to the band at the time we were doing it?
Right.
Because that was my whole life, the X's for like 12-year period that we were going. And when that all started to fall apart, it was very painful. And, you know, and I had to go through a mourning period there because I watched what I had loved the most die. Yeah. And I think all of that kind of started to seep into the formation of a song. And I came up with that title, For What It's Worth. This is the document. This is how I lived this part of my life. And I just hope that it was enough, because I guess looking back, I wouldn't change anything. You know, it gave me great satisfaction, and it gave me great life experience. Happiness, pain, all of it is life experience, and we grow from all of it.
Right.
So that's where it started from. And it became this like love letter to the life I've led so far, to the band, everybody in the band, to David, who had passed, our guitar player, you know, and it just, that's kind of where I went with it, you know, and a couple of, you know, years of digging in on it and going back to it, kind of like a diary, and filling in the blanks where I was having troubles, and then finally I finished it. And
yeah.
And I thought it was kind of a neat dichotomy that it was kind of a banger of a song.
Yeah.
With a pretty, sure, like, intense lyric rather than a ballad, you know?
Indeed, man. Well, you know, since we last talked, and obviously we covered this in Artificial, but AI just, you know, I don't know how to handle it. It's coming so fast in so many different facets, you know, especially in the music industry where there's, you know, rules or laws or whatever trying to protect artists from someone sounding exactly like them. I mean, there is a copyright to your sound or to your likeness or something like that, but it's a train that's coming fast, man. So, you know, you're in the middle of it, not only as a songwriter, but as a producer and living it every day. What are you feeling on AI right now, man?
I guess I try to avoid it right now.
Yeah.
And I try to stay as organic as possible, even though, I mean, you guys can't see my studio here, but like, I'm what they call in the box. You know, I don't have a big SSL console, and I'm, you know, but I'm working out of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm, you know, I've got guitars. I play the bass. I play, you know, I program my drums sometimes. It depends on what it is. If I really feel like I need organic drums, then I record them.
Right.
But, I don't think there's any escaping AI. I think that we are going to find great uses for it. I think we're going to find nightmare issues with it.
Yeah.
And I feel that we are just going to have to keep going to kind of go through this technological adolescence, if you will,
mm-hmm.
that we have right now. And it's going to be a little painful because every kind of new tier, I guess, in humanity comes with its successes and its losses. And so you just got to try to navigate it, you know, use your judgment the best you can on it. I think people will always long for something that feels very human.
Yeah.
I think it'll take a while for AI to have a, you know, artificial soul, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
I think we'll know the difference. Yeah, I heard an Amy Winehouse song that was all AI.
Oh.
And it's like, okay, it was a decent song, but I didn't feel the heartbeat in it.
Right.
That's not saying I'm trying to be defiant to it. I just didn't,
yeah.
you know? So maybe they'll perfect that as time goes on. But I think there's always still going to be a need for, you know, the relationship between, you know, what we do with art, you know, whether mm-hmm. we're looking at a painting, we're listening to a song, we're watching a movie, we're acting in a play, where the art of even like your body to compete in the Olympics. It's all, you know, it all still, humans love that kind of, I guess just that humanity of things.
Right.
You know, we, the imperfection of it all.
Yeah, sure.
We do. We're drawn to it in because that's what we are.
Yeah. And I think that really goes not only in music, but sports, too. I mean, can you imagine just watching perfection of someone hitting the three-pointer every time in March Madness?
Every time. It's a little boring.
It would totally be boring.
It would be boring.
Back to Scott and Dorothy. Obviously, you know, Scott was on the show a few weeks ago, and he was telling me when, you know, he finally decided that, you know, he knew that you were working with Dorothy, and he was like, man, this song, you know, If the Walls Could Talk would be perfect for her. Please make sure she hears it, and blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, man, Scott was so busy, and I'm calling him every day. He's like, did you record it yet? I'm so anxious to hear it. So when you finally got around to it, man, what was that like, you know, putting Scott's work with Dorothy there when you were in the studio?
Here's the thing. I had the song for a little while. I wrote it with Stapp and Kylie Sackley and Marty Fredrickson. We wrote Walls. And I do believe that I might have made a suggestion early on that I knew an artist that I was getting ready to work with. Because I don't think Dorothy and I had really started yet. I mean, we'd worked on Rest in Peace and Black Sheep from the last record.
Yeah.
But I think I said her name. I can't be certain about that, but I do believe I said something about her. And, you know, it was such early days, whatever. So when it finally came around, and I think Scott and Dorothy played a show in Montana together, mm-hmm. and then I think it kind of, once he heard her voice, he called me, goes, that's the girl for the song. I'm like, yeah, I think that's the girl I was telling you about.
Yeah.
And I got the track, and we had to basically kind of wait for a window to present it to her and for her to be ready to do it. And I do remember showing it to her, and she was very moved by it.
Mm-hmm.
Very moved. And then I think it took a couple weeks that she sat with it, and we figured out the time. I said, come on up from San Diego. And we got on the mic, and it sounded good right away, but it didn't. It's not the magic that you heard. I think it took her and I a minute to figure out what the approach was.
Right.
And because it was so naked, at that time it was Scott's voice and an acoustic guitar, and that was it.
Wow.
So when you only have one other voice and one guitar, you have to learn how to put yourself in with that instrumentation. And once she settled into that groove, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I just remember like getting chills and looking at her, and I didn't say anything to boost her confidence, and I didn't say anything to hurt her confidence. I just kind of was looking at her in awe, going, I don't think you realize like what's happening right now.
Yeah.
And how good this really is. So I'm just going to keep you working, you know, so that I can get all the pieces and I'll put a comp together. But it was magical. When she hit that vein, it was like hitting a gold vein, you know, and it just, man, it's magical, that song. It's beautiful.
The thing that I really love about your approach to really, as you said, you got to listen to figure out where to go. And that's one thing I admire about you. I just saw Starbenders a couple of nights ago with Nita Strauss. And the thing that I really love about hearing her music recorded and then even seeing her, how she pulls it off live, is she is different. I mean, it sounds different. It almost is kind of reflective of a Susie and the Banshees era in a way, the way that not that she sounds, but just how that music was different then. It didn't sound like everything else. And she's in a world right now where she stands out. Even though she hasn't had a lot of success, I mean, they said the biggest challenge for the band is just making sure people hear their music. And that's why they were loved getting on the radio and talking about it. But when you work with an artist like Kimmy, what's your approach, man? Because it doesn't sound like Dorothy, or it doesn't sound like Ash from New Year's Day or Lizzie. I mean, what's your approach to an artist like that?
Well, Kimmy, the first time I saw her, I was with Lilith Czar, and she was friends with Kimmy. And she took me to see them in Nashville at this little place. I think it's called The End. And it may be like, you know, I think 100 people in there. It's packed.
Yeah.
I thought they were really different. I thought she was kind of like a female Bowie kind of thing, although I mean Bowie had a female thing going on anyway. But like they were very rock and roll, and she was very confident, and it was like, huh, you know. And then I met her after that show. We sat outside, and she said something I'll never forget. She goes, so how's it feel breathing that rarefied air? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you've had a lot of success and number ones, and a lot of people, you know, that's not enough in the music business, they would like the success that you that you have. And I said, well, that's very nice of you to say. I said, I don't really look at it like that. I just, I have my wins and my losses, and I've been in this game a very long time. So, but thank you for the compliment. And then that opened up the way of just talking about music. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until last year, I think I was in Nashville and I got a call and she said, I have this song that I can't seem to finish. Would you like me, would you like to work with me on it? And it was called The Game.
Oh yeah.
And that was my first time ever writing with her. We wrote it over the phone and over, not even over Zoom, just over the phone.
Wow.
Trading files, you know, sending each other voice messages. Like, it goes like this, you know, and and then they laid it down and, we, you know, I would hear a mix and go, well, maybe try the part, but, you know, a little bit different here. And I was working with her manager as well, Nico,
yeah,
who's really great. And we crafted it. And that was our very first time working together. I would love to be like in person with her, maybe get a song from the ground up,
mm-hmm.
See what happens. But yeah, she is unique. You're right.
You know, something you said earlier about where, you know, once For What It's Worth or any of your songs is out there, it's not really yours anymore. And there was a quote you said, you know, about this after it came out. I think you might have posted it on Instagram where you said the song isn't mine anymore. It's yours. Sometimes you have to lose it all to do the best you can do. Your choices shape you and you do the best with what is given. In the end, for me, I hope it was enough. I mean, that's it right there. I mean, I don't know what else you can add to that, but I really love that, man, about you. And it just shows me what kind of person you are and what kind of artist you are. And I don't know if there's anything else you can say about that.
I don't really. I think that clocks it pretty good. I guess I want people to understand is that sometimes life is weird and that when you're going after something and you want it and you see all these things that collide into you and maybe they're obstacles and maybe they're just hurdles and you get over them, but there's always a plan. And I feel that sometimes when you lose, you win. And for me, the Xyz taking its road that it took and the way it stopped, I could have never predicted that that would put me in the seat that I'm at now and work with the artists that I've worked with. And then put me back into writing songs with the band again, sitting here with you talking about that. So sometimes there's a plan that's bigger than you. And sometimes you have to just learn how to pay attention to it and pay attention to those signs and just know there's always a way you're going to land on your feet if you just keep moving. And that's what I think that song is saying, is that I had to lose the band to do better in life.
Right. Yeah.
And now here I am back with the band and it's like a reunion and, you know, it's all hugs and smiles and it's pretty amazing what's percolating right now.
And, you know, I've hit you up many times asking would there ever be a live show, and you just said it. There is a reunion not only that is going to be literally happening May 29th at the Viper Room in L.A., but, you know, when did it finally, you go like, you put it down to paper, you say, man, this is, we got a club, we got songs, it's reunion time. When did this really get seriously where you knew it was going to happen?
It got serious in January.
Okay.
And we had a talk, and because I was in Brazil for New Year's, and I basically had a lot of time on my hands because there's just beach culture down there, which I'm not complaining. I mean, it was sitting there on, but you get reflective and you think. And as soon as I got back, I called the guys, because we'd already been talking anyway about the possibility, but I said, I think we got to pull the trigger on this. It's the 20th anniversary of Head for the Door, mm-hmm. which was our biggest record. We had our biggest single, Ugly, on that album. And I said, I think we ought to do a reunion show and just kind of see how it goes. And everybody said, where are you thinking? And I said, well, I think we should go where it all began, the Viper Room.
Right.
That's where we signed. I mean, everything that happened for this band happened out of that place. And I mean, it's a small place, but it's family, it's home. I know Tommy Black forever that runs that place and, you know, is my friend and helped me book this show. And, you know, we're going to jump into the deep end. We're just going to do it. And, you know, we're going to play the songs that a lot of people, I hope, love. And then we're going to take it from there, you know? So it's more is coming. I will say that, you know, more music's coming. But I got to get through this first show And then I would think that if that goes well, then why wouldn't we play more?
So how do you prepare for this? I mean, it's been, you know, years since all of you were together on stage. I mean, is there a lot of rehearsals? I mean, and not only are you preparing just to make sure you still got the licks for the songs or whatever, but it goes a lot into your head, man, mentally. So how do you prepare for this show? Because, I mean, it's coming up in, you know, less than 2 months now.
I think it's a great question, Lloyd. I've kind of been I think I started kind of like dabbling and learning the songs again in November. And, you know, just within my acoustic and kind of strumming and trying to remember. And then it hasn't been until, you know, like January that I've actually started to practice.
Right.
And I turn on my amp, I put on the guitar, I set up a fake mic, you know, just so that I can kind of get used to the muscle memory of all of it again.
Yeah.
And I put on the songs and I just play with them. And, you know, listening to myself sing and, you know, trying to follow it as best as I can. And I think it just is, like you said, it's muscle memory. It's repetitiveness. It's been a long time since I've done this, since any of us have done it. I mean, Freddie, our bass player, is in Everclear, so he's playing all the time.
Right.
He never stopped. But yeah, it's daunting. You know, look, if it doesn't scare you a little bit, it probably isn't worth it.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, it's a little intimidating, but I also did this for 12 years. I played probably 1,000 shows, you know, so I'm not expecting it to be perfect. I'm not expecting it to be awful. I'm expecting to try to have as much fun as I can, basically just be in the moment. And I believe everybody that's there knows that it's been a long time since we've played it. And everybody knows all the songs that's coming,
right.
You know, so maybe we'll get a little bit of support that way.
Yeah. Well, don't AI yourself and clone it to make it perfect, man. We want you to have a few of those imperfections.
Oh, and it will. Trust me.
Well, hey, man, thank you again for being on The Rock 30. I can't wait to keep playing this song. And hey, man, if it takes 30 weeks to get to number one, I mean, I'm patient and I think you are too, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, that would be incredible. You know, if the people are feeling it, then, you know, let Lloyd know.
Yeah.
And we'll keep playing it.
All right. Well, hey, man, have a great day, and I hope to see you soon.
I hope to see you too again, brother. Thank you so much.